Good morning, everybody. I'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order. This day is February 15th, 2022. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Mr. Brinks, can you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson's present.
Carlson is present. Representative Nash.
Nash present.
Nash is present. Representative Bonner.
Bonner present.
Bonner is present. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Drazkowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn is present. Representative Posnick. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason is present. Representative New Brindley. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski present.
Pulowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Quam is present. Representative Posnick. Representative New Brindley. Oh, New Brindley is entering right now. Representative New Brindley, are you present?
Present.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. With that, Chair Nelson, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Brinks. Next we have, they have a quorum present. The next item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from February 14th. Representative Cleavorn, did you get a chance to peruse the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes for February 14th.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes for February 14th. If everybody wants to unmute, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Our minutes have been approved. First bill we have on the day this morning, members, is House File 2618, Representative Hansen. And I'd like to be done with this bill by a little after 9 o'clock, if that's possible. We've got two other bills on the agenda today. So, Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2618 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Minnesotans watching at home. Minnesota has been on a journey of protecting pollinators for nearly 10 years. And during that time, we have invested in a lot of research at the University of Minnesota. And some of that research has shown us that even small tracts of land can provide a great benefit for pollinators. Pollinators are diverse, and having diverse landscapes provides for diverse pollinators and diverse critters everywhere. And that we are part of that web of life, not just the pollinators. So what 2618 does, if you take a look at it, it says a statutory city or home rule chartered city shall allow an owner, authorized agent, or authorized occupant of any privately owned lands or premises to install and maintain a managed natural landscape. So this allows pollinator gardens. This is not requiring pollinator gardens. It's not mandating pollinator gardens. But what it does, it allows property owners in a city to have a pollinator garden that has benefits beyond pollinators. It has benefits for water quality, soil health, and general health, helping out people. I have a lot of testifiers today, and you have a lot of written testimony, some great testimony in your packet. So I will cease talking and allow the testifiers to make the case.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. The first testifier I have on my list is Elaine Evans. If you want to introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Elaine Evans. I'm at the University of Minnesota Bee Lab. And I have a couple visuals I wanted to share with, to go along with my testimony. So I wanted to talk to you today about how the Bee Lab, I'm representing the talk with other people at the Bee Lab too, the researchers are all really excited about this bill because native plants are really crucial habitat for pollinators. One pollinator in particular that we've worked on a lot at the Bee Lab is the rusty patch bumblebee, which is an endangered species. And Minnesota is one of the few states where we still find the rusty patch bumblebee. Most of the recent sightings are on private property, mostly in urban areas. The goal of any listing as an endangered species is to get that population to recover so it can be delisted. And the best way to do that is by providing habitat. And doing that within cities is going to be actually one of the best ways to do this. I mean, that they occur outside of cities as well. But small, as Representative Hansen was saying, even small tracts of flowering habitat that people can put in on private property can make a huge difference for these pollinators. In addition to the rusty patch bumblebee, we're also concerned about bees that are, we call them specialists. So some bees, like the rusty patch bumblebee, will actually visit a wide range of flowers, but there are other bees that will only visit one particular kind of flower, and we call these specialists. They really rely on those native plants, and having a diversity of native plants is the best way to serve them. Representative Hansen mentioned that there are also these multiple benefits. So a lot of these native plants have these deep roots, a lot of multiple benefits with water quality, all kinds of other wildlife that's supported. So I wanted to mention that here in Minnesota, we're really poised to help people put in pollinator habitat. A lot of people that we talk to have been limited by rules about where they can grow the plants that they want to grow to help pollinators. And so this bill is something that would help people to take the action that we hope that they take, that they're wanting to take. We also have a lot of resources here within Minnesota, within the Bee Lab, within the Board of Water and Soil Quality, soil resources, as well as native plant producers and native landscapers that can really help people do this and do this well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Next person I have on the list is Heidi Heiland. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Heidi Heiland. 43 years ago, I planted the seeds of my landscape gardening company. 6 years ago, I bought a nursery and garden center in Corcoran. We are called Grow House and Lifestyle Gardens. I'm also past president of the MNLA, the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I have informed many diverse customers over the years, and these are my schooled beliefs of why it is important to support House File 2618 for our industry and for the health of our planet. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, and Representative Hansen for hearing my testimony. Nature.
Oh, thought you were done. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Nature heals. Period. This has been proven by many, from scientists to NASA, and by peer-reviewed papers written by horticultural therapists. Not surprisingly, during COVID, more of the world has come to know what many of us have been practicing for years. Being in nature, or even viewing scenes of nature, reduces stress, lowers heart rate, relieves pain, and increases happiness. Not only does nature improve our personal well-being, but diverse plantings, and even more specifically, native plantings, provide a myriad of necessary benefits to our world. Supporting this request for private property rights increases our potential to heal the planet, one garden at a time. The next generation understands the importance of a managed natural landscape. The expected Kentucky bluegrass lawn is not native, nor is it natural. A typical urban lawn requires copious amounts of water, and mowing it weekly creates unnecessary noise and air pollution. Water is a limited resource that we need to protect. Native plants are adapted to their environments and are therefore more drought tolerant. Proper landscaping reduces nitrate leaching from the soil into our water supply and also reduces surface water runoff, keeping phosphorus and other pollutants out of our waterways, thus preventing septic system overload. Lastly, by now, we should all be familiar with the reality that natural habitats are essential for our birds, bees, and butterflies to thrive. The flora and fauna of every region plays a key role in a healthy ecosystem. Reversing the effects of climate change, honoring water, food, and healing will only be achieved by encouraging all homeowners to grow more plants. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hyland. The next person on my list is Jason Rathi.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Jason Rathi, owner of Field Landscaping in Northeast Minneapolis. And I'd actually like to share my screen too, if everybody can see this. Just going to kind of leave it up at the back here, the front yard in our service area. Hello, thank you for having me to talk on this important issue. My name is Jason Rathi. I live in St. Louis Park and own Field Outdoor Spaces, a residential design build landscape company in Northeast Minneapolis that we started in 2005. We've been helping clients design and install natural landscapes for over 16 years. I'm here to talk about the importance of allowing natural landscapes in our residential communities. While traditional cool season grass lawns are a fine option for covering ground, there are other options that can be a better option for supporting our pollinator communities, decreasing water use, and decreasing energy consumption of mowers and other lawn equipment. The options are many. Alternative lawns like no-mow fescue grass, dynamic flower and grass lawn mixes like the Bee Lawn, advocated by the State of Minnesota's Lawns to Legumes program, and many types of planted short grass meadows. Some of these include native plants and others are primarily adapted plant species appropriate for our climate and residential landscape. These landscape options, like the one that you're seeing in the picture, not only offer ecological advantages, but when well designed can be tidy, visually appealing, straightforward to manage, and an asset to the community streetscape. At Field, we are able to help our clients achieve their goals because of ordinances that allow natural landscapes. And I think that it's important that everyone in Minnesota have that option. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rathi. The next person I have on my list is Tim Maluli. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. You're muted, sir. You're still muted.
There we go. I'm sorry. Can you hear
me
now?
That's okay. I can hear you now. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. My name is Tim Maluli. I am a member of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, past president and its current government affairs chair. The Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association is a statewide big tent organization, as we like to call it, representing the entirety of the nursery and landscape industry in the state of Minnesota. We have about 1,200 member companies employing 30 to 45,000 folks seasonally throughout the state and representing billions of dollars of revenue to the state of Minnesota. We are the folks who design, install, and maintain the landscapes and the built environment. My personal specialty is in water resources, but I focus today on behalf of MNLA to offer some information that might help create a clearing for greater Minnesota communities as well as larger cities to workably adopt modernized local ordinances related to managed natural landscapes. Older nuisance laws were founded with good intentions to protect public health, welfare, and safety. However, weed ordinances that restrict natural landscaping have become increasingly outdated as a result of growing evidence that native landscapes don't contribute to fire risk, vermin, mosquitoes, or pollen proliferation. In addition, nuisance ordinances that fail to provide to define particular vegetation to be controlled have been ruled vague by some courts. This is information from the Environmental Protection Agency that I'm citing. The new generation of plant ordinances helps local bodies address potential violations that result from restrictions over individual landscaping choices that don't serve a public benefit. Most weed laws currently regulate landscaping based on broad physical plant characteristics, For instance, restrictions on brush, seed-bearing plants, and plants capable of large growth. Another obstacle is an ordinance provision that restricts plant growth beyond a specific height. In the 1990s, municipalities began adopting a new generation of ordinances or code amendments to protect native plants. Some revisions include the addition of a section in the nuisance ordinance that's titled Managed Natural Landscapes or Planned Natural Landscapes. These ordinance revisions exempt areas designated by the landowner from the weed ordinance. Other revisions refine ordinance terms to distinguish intentional plant growth from unmanaged turf grass growth. In 2011, Minneapolis altered its noxious plant ordinance to make a simple three-category distinction between, one, noxious weeds, defined by existing statutes, two, unmaintained growth, and three, intentional growth, called managed natural landscapes. These landscapes are defined as planned, intentional, and maintained plantings of native and non-native plants. Plants that fall in the category are allowed to exceed an 8-inch height limit for grasses as long as they're absent of noxious weeds and the plants don't constitute a health, safety, or fire risk. The ordinance does not include setback requirements and no government or neighborhood review process is necessary. So I offer this information in regard to this statewide piece of legislation as workable. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Maloli. The next person I have and the last person I have on my list is Sam Frampton. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and everyone participating. Is my audio okay?
We can hear you fine.
Thank you. Scott Frampton, I'm a Woodbury, South Washington County resident and co-owner of Landscape Renovations, which is a residential landscape installation and maintenance firm in the South Washington County area. I am also the past president of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, and I agree with the rest of my colleagues in supporting HF 2618. All of the benefits of the managed natural landscape that my colleagues have mentioned are absolutely true. One of the concerns that many have mentioned are the unmanaged aspects of the potential noxious weeds in the managed natural landscape. Many of the noxious weeds are easily identifiable for most uneducated professionals in terms of identifying and weeding out in the managed natural landscape. It is the least of our concerns. Regarding the benefits, the gardens attract butterflies and hummingbirds. They sequester CO2. They reduce water consumption. They reduce the use of pesticides. They improve the soil. They reduce runoff. They create jobs for nursery and landscape professionals. The benefits far outweigh the minimal potential of noxious weeds. That's my testimony. Thank you, Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Frampton. With that, members, I open up for questions, and I got a text from Representative Nash. He would like to go first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly recognize the value of wild plants, and I think Representative Hansen in here has rain gardens. When I was mayor in Waconia, we actually installed rain gardens, both as a runoff control issue, but also to promote good health for our areas. But I find it troubling, and I thought the League of Minnesota Cities was going to be testifying today, that here we have a bill from Representative Hansen that is effectively stifling the voice of local governments who I believe are opposed to this, because it says shall, not may, but it shall allow an owner to do this. But I find it concerning that on certain bills, I don't know, perhaps brought by me, I am regularly pilloried for being anti-local control. And yet we've got a bill here that effectively says to municipalities across the state, you're going to do this. You're going to have a great time while it's happening, and you can just sit down and be quiet. I think it's very troubling that we rush to these bills when it's an issue that you like, but when it's an issue you don't like, you choose to beat the drum of local control. And I, again, my wife and I plant plants that promote bees, and we have hummingbirds, and I'm looking forward to seeing those things again when we get rid of all this snow. But I just find this to be particularly noteworthy event to point out the hypocrisy that so many of you have on issues like this, that when it's something that you want to rush towards and hug all the bees and hug all the wildflowers and talk lovingly and wax rhapsodically about all these things, but when you talk about housing and the shortage of housing that we have, and we're trying to remedy some of the housing issues, that you then take out your own drum to beat regarding local control. So I think for those of you that have been so keen to point out how awful many bills are because it takes away local control, I would expect to see a no vote out of you. So for that reason, Mr. Chair, I'm going to request a roll call on this bill and encourage people to vote no.
Representative Nash has required a roll call, but Representative Nash, that's required on all bills that have to go to go to the General Register. But thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question for the author. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I hope you're having a good day. I was reading your bill, and I have mixed feelings about it. Unlike Representative Nash, I think local control is the individual, and so I like that part of your bill to actually give property rights to people and disallow local governments from continuing to take more and more individual decisions and rights away from people. However, on the flip side of that, I don't know. I mean, the Twin Cities is pretty big, but in relation to the rest of the state, I don't know that would make a huge difference on the number of bees. And on a different note, maybe a different day, I'm wondering what the updated bee count is in Minnesota. But as I look at the bill, I think there's some problems you'll want to fix in it. I have no idea how I'm going to vote on this bill yet, but line 2.10, you say any weeds or grasses growing upon any lot or parcel of land. As you know, Representative Hansen, a weed is a plant in an unwanted place. So is there a definition for weeds that would cover this new part of statute somewhere else in the chapter, or is that a missing piece in the bill?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. I was kind of hoping you'd be with me on freedom here, that this is a property rights issue. And, you know, if you choose to have an echinacea on your lawn growing to attract bees or just because you like it, and I live next door and don't, it's not my responsibility to tell you or to complain to the local government and say you shouldn't have that echinacea plant growing on your property. That's just my opinion. So I think we may have some common ground there. And I think just a little bit on the statewide nature, if you look in the testimony, and I can't remember which of the written testimony, it references a case in Mankato, I believe, where the city actually went, took a person to court. I believe he was a retired botany professor who had his lawn designed for the outdoors. So, taking him to court because he had that habitat. So I think what we're talking about here is we're saying the cities should allow, because right now, and I believe that's why you see the number of small businesses that testified here, because they run into it where they may install something and then the landowner may run into a problem with the city. And the English country manor lawn that was kind of the standard after the World War II post-war generation of putting in lawns, our lawns aren't Versailles. You know, we that diversity that we have is a property owner's choice. To your question on that last section, that is the part that most people have had concerns about. And actually, that's where, if you just read the title, that's what sticks out at you. But I believe, as Mr. Maluli mentioned, that's kind of the language that has been used on managed landscapes and having that 8 inches. So the concern that was raised was, well, you can't just let your lawn go. and any weeds, and a weed is out of place, I would feel and am open to inserting the word noxious before weeds, because I think we reference that higher up in the in the bill. But I would maybe refer back to Mr. Mullooly to give a little bit of precedent on that type of language on managed landscapes with weeds.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, is Mr. Mullooly going to come in as Representative Hansen suggested or no?
If you would like it, Mr. Mullooly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski and Representative Hansen. The commentary is legitimate across the board. What is a weed versus what is a plant? And quite frankly, for longer than I've been alive, we've been talking about this as in our society. And I can tell you that there are active and influential government-sponsored organizations or groups or stakeholders that meet regularly, including the Noxious Weed Council through the state of Minnesota, that analyze the definitions of what makes a weed, and more importantly, perhaps, analyze the plant makeup from year to year that are listed as one degree or another of an invasive plant that needs to be regulated or that might need to be eradicated. And there are other categories as well related to the classification of a plant and its usefulness to the public good. I'm not sure if that answers the question or not. I would like to be brief, and I'll ask if you need clarification. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's helpful. And Representative Hansen, I look at line 2.4, means a lawn comprised mostly of grasses commonly used in, you know, as we know, if you seed a lawn or, sod a lawn, it will change in composition from one year to the next and can go from all bluegrass to all weeds if you let it happen. Again, depending on what your definition of a weed is, and everybody's definition of a weed is different. Some of these people that plant these native plantations include thistles and other things in their mixes, depending on where they're planting them. One person will think that thistle is a wonderful plant to have there and how beautiful the flowers are, and look at the bees and butterflies attracted to it, and someone else will say, that's a weed and it should be on the noxious weed list. So that's where we run into problems here, and I think you understand that well, Representative Hansen. And maybe what you need to do is give some sort of process for the local government to, through citizen input or something, to bring those definitions for that local government. I could see where that might happen, and it might be different from one community to another. Again, thank you for the discussion. Thank you, Representative Hansen and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. I see Representative Nash has his hand up again. Representative
Yes,
Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I wanted to correct my colleague, Representative Drazkowski. I am advocating and have advocated for property rights for a very long time, namely those of builders and potential homeowners, and that's what I'm trying to draw the incongruencies to, and I'm not shilling for the League of Minnesota Cities by any stretch of the imagination, so please correct that in your mind. But I find it, again, very interesting that we're going to love all over this bill, or many of you will, and ignore the pleas of builders and ignore the pleas of potential homeowners when they're simply trying to utilize their property in a manner that they see fit by building a certain type of house on their bill, on their land they'd like. So please correct that in your mind, Representative Drazkowski, because you got it wrong.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Thanks. I'll try to keep it short, but I just want to say thank you to Representative Hansen for bringing this bill forward. I think any opportunity we have to bring more native plants into the landscape is a real win. I personally have been doing that over the last several years, trying to incorporate those beautiful echinacea into my own gardens as well as other native plants. They're beautiful, they're functional, they're lovely, and they really do bring the pollinators to the table. And being able to see that is really quite fascinating. Although
as Representative Nash suggests, I don't think I will hug them outright, but certainly I love them to death. And I will say that here up in Maple Grove, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years ago, we actually had sightings of the rusty patch bumblebee right near my home. And so certainly I'm grateful for that and hope that we can continue to move forward and have landscapes that allow that to happen.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any further questions from the members? Any further questions? If not, Representative Hansen, you can wrap up and then we'll proceed to a vote. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm asking for your support. I hope you can be part of the change.
With that, Mr. Brinks, can you please take the roll on the bill? Well, first, I'll renew my motion that House File 2618 be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson votes yes.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Nash, no.
Nash votes nay. Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drozdowski.
No.
Drozdowski votes nay. Representative Elkins.
Elkins aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne aye.
Cleborne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley?
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski votes aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam?
No.
Quam votes nay. With a vote of 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you for that. And thank you, Representative Hansen. And proceed on your way. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 2894. Hewitt, I will move that House File 2894 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Hewitt, if you want to explain your bill and what it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's always great to be back in front of such a great committee. I have roots in this committee, so it's wonderful. And I'm sorry I can't bring you a snack today. Last night, Angela made this beautiful Rice Krispie bar with chocolate on top, and I would have brought it in today so you guys could have had it, but I want your mouths all watering right now. So anyways, this
Representative Hewitt, you could always Uber it out to all of us.
If I could afford it, Mr. Chair, if I could afford it. Anyways, this bill is actually a quite interesting bill. It's not one normally that I would probably carry, but it's about two things, local control and public safety. My county came to me and asked me to do this bill. We have it's a subordinate taxing district that they want to start. Most places around the state can do this already, except in the metro area. I believe outside of Anoka County, I believe they're doing it. But the county provides police protection for the southernmost part of our county, which has a lot of high-speed traffic. Their call volumes are going up. And because right now the public safety is funded by the entire county, it gives very limited control to the locals if they want to, for instance, up a sheriff. So I think this is a really good bill. It local control and public safety, I think, are the theme of it. Today I have with, in fact, I had a D amendment on this that we changed over in local government. Basically what that did was only make it exclusive to Dakota County in the metro. Other counties had issues with this, so the stakeholders pulled back and just said they want it just for Dakota County, just to explain that DE that was done. But I have two people with me that know a lot more about this subject, Commissioner Salwick and Sheriff Leslie. Mr. Chair, if they could be called up to speak right now, that would be wonderful.
Just one second, housekeeping. I missed a step here. Again, I'll go back to committee. This is the first division report we've gotten from our local government subcommittee of ours. So Representative Mason, I see there's a division report that we need to adopt. Do you want to make that motion? Chair Mason? If not, I'll move the adoption of the division report for House File 2894. And members, you can unmute. And all in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
The division report's been adopted. And now I'll make my motion to properly make my motion to refer House File 2894 to the General Register. And again, we have testifiers. First one on my list is Commissioner Slawick. Welcome to the committee and welcome back to the legislature.
Thank you. Good morning.
That's not the wrong Slawick. I'm sorry.
I have a different one. Yes.
Yep. I'm sorry. Forgive me for that.
That is quite all right, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Slawick. I am a Dakota County Commissioner representing the southern part of Dakota County. That is all 13 of the townships of southern Dakota County and the cities of Farmington and Hastings. Just so you're aware, you do have an attachment that does have the shaded area, which is the patrol division of the Dakota County Sheriff's Department. That is about 50% of the geographic land of the county. And as was stated by Representative Hewitt, we are seeking authority to go in and create a subordinate taxing district for increased public safety needs for the rural areas. Currently, 95% of the cost of providing that service for the public safety for those parts of the county is paid for by cities and in the northern part of the county. So what that ultimately results in is those areas of the county are paying 95% of the cost of the services, but are receiving 0% of those actual services provided. An example of that is cities of Lakeville and Eagan, for example. Those cities and residents and businesses are paying for the cost of public safety. However, they are also additionally being double taxed by paying for those services within their own local police departments. With that, I should also note that we do have the support of the Township Officers Association in doing this. And really what we are looking to do, Sheriff Leslie will certainly talk a little more about what this is, but as we're seeing more growing costs and growing need for public safety, it is not just in one part or one township versus the other. So we're really looking for a contiguous area to be able to go in, similar to a fire district, where you're able to go in and create additional revenue and be paid for by those users, those residents and businesses of the rural area, to be able to pay for increased services within public safety for that area. And I know that I will certainly be available for questions, but I know that Sheriff Leslie can talk a little bit about what that means. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Slavik, and hang around for any questions for you. Welcome to the committee, Sheriff Leslie, if you want to identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Tim Leslie, the sheriff in Dakota County, and you can blame this all on me if you like. So our circumstances are rather unique. We kept feeling like we didn't have enough deputies to adequately patrol the 350 square miles that the deputies work in. And we were lagging behind in our call answering. We were not able to back up each other, and so we asked the county to study it. And sure enough, lo and behold, we found out that for 30 years, we've had the same number of deputies patrolling 350 square miles. And I you know, put $100 on the table. I don't know where we'd find another organization that has kept the same level of staffing for 30 years, right? So we're very proud of the fact that we been able to maintain that, but the ship was sinking. We were taking on water, as you'd say. So we did a study. We have an Office of Planning and Analysis in Dakota County that we use towards research and development. They did a study. The county had grown by 50% in those 30 years. The patrol area that I have deputies in had grown by 22% in those 30 years. All we were asking for was an additional 20% of our staffing, which would be four deputies. The county found one within the, you know, budgetary constraints that we have, and now we're seeking an additional three. Because what was happening is the additional pressures of training on law enforcement was also forcing deputies to do more training. We were away from the workplace more and more. And we found ourselves many times having just two deputies and a supervisor working all night. And sometimes those deputies are running from Hastings to Eureka, and that's about a 45-minute run. And so we weren't really providing for the public safety like we felt. So we researched this. We came to the county board. The county board agreed, and then Commissioner Slavik got involved when he tries to find the money. And he's been very helpful in crafting this and working with Representative Hewitt to try to figure this out. And I'll stay for questions if you need me.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. With that, members, any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to find out if any other county charges extra for some of the people for public service.
Representative Hewitt or somebody have the answer to Representative Hewitt?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of the answer, so I can definitely check on it. I know, Representative Quam, your questions are always intriguing, and we did look into the question you had in local government, and the county really feels that this is the best manner that they can go about this to be fair and equitable to all their constituents. So, but I can definitely check on that, Representative Quam. I believe there is, but that's just an opinion. It's not a fact at this point. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had queried on that before because one thing, a lot of things sound great. Understanding whether you're setting a new precedent or not, I think is sort of important when we look at legislation. You know, when I look at this, it's saying because part of a county doesn't use a county function, the people that use a county function should pay more of a pay for service thing. But there's a lot of things that the counties do. So if each service is then switched to, well, this part of the population uses this service more, so we're going to charge them more, I think that's a problematic precedent to set. Because frankly, we have, in my understanding, the general thing is you have an assessment across the county. You got a similar thing for library fees, you know, et cetera. And if you're a resident, you pay to the county, and then the county provides a service, and some people need one service more than other people. And so, in general, now it might be universal, but in general, we don't say we're going to charge you because you're going to need a service. We say we're a government that's providing core essential services, and we're collecting to take care of that. I understand the differences between city and county police, but a core function is providing public safety. And, you know, I have concerns about this as a precedence. Government shouldn't be all fee for service. It should be a lot of it for the common good and for basic services. So that's where my main issue here is. And it's disappointing that the second committee that I've asked the question of what are the precedents out there, I haven't been able to get an answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam, I see that Sheriff Leslie and Commissioner Slavik have their hands up. Sheriff Leslie, you have possibly shed some light.
Yeah, I would just offer, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I would just offer that only the patrol division would be affected by this. So again, when you look at the vast services that the sheriff's office provides, the only thing that would be an additional revenue stream just for patrol is this circumstance that we're talking about here. It would not affect the jail funding. Everything else would be levied against the people in the entire county, except only those areas where
only the patrol division operates, which is in the townships. So if that helps at all to clarify, and I'll defer to the commissioner if he can articulate that better than I.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. Commissioner Slawick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a couple points on that is, first on the point that the sheriff had said is that, you know, unlike a library service, every single resident of the county has the opportunity to receive that service. They are paying for it, whether they choose to go to a library or check out a book or that. That is very different than a majority of the taxpayers actually paying for a service that they in no way, unless they choose to own property in that southern part of that district, do not receive that benefit. So I think that was kind of the difference on that one is that this is truly a unique situation in that it's not necessarily a fee for service. Or the fact of the matter is that these are only the individuals in this specific district receive that benefit. The best examples of that are actually on the fire safety side of things, as was noted that. So there is not really an example in the public safety law enforcement aspect, with the exception somewhat of Anoka County. And I think I'd stated that at the previous committee as well. But that is a little bit different than from what is being asked for by Dakota County. But the best example that we can really use is the fire protection that is done in a given area. For example, within my district, it does actually border Rice County and Goodhue County, and they do have fire districts that use a supported taxing district. But then it does go into Dakota County, and they're on a different system because on the metro area that is not allowed. So I know that we're still working to get you the best examples, but those are the only two that come to mind towards your point, Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, you know, maybe it's just the counties I'm around. I don't think I've heard of a county fire department. I've heard of, and I'm very familiar with, cities will have a fire department, and there'll be employees and et cetera. Where I'm from, we've got volunteer fire departments, and there are arrangements of where townships and some towns will contribute to them and fund them, but that's not a county function, is in my understanding. And the fact that you might not use all of the services provided by a county department, I don't think is an excuse for saying we're going to, you know, charge more if you actually, you know, this is a core function. And frankly, you know, the fire department is a not a equivalent, because it's not a county function that I've heard, unless someone in staff can inform me of how many counties in the state of Minnesota have a county fire department.
Representative Hewitt, you've got your hand up. Can you shed some light?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Quam, I'm not sure if you're on taxes or not, but actually, we do have subordinate taxing districts when it comes to fire taxing districts, which has been in legislation for several years now, as well as we put ambulance taxing districts, and that can get up to the micro level of the city. So not to say I agree with them, but the bottom line is that they are out there, and that serves just a population of that city, not of the whole county. And so we do have same and similar around the state, not in your area as much as, for example, the city of Cloquet has a fire taxing district. So I am familiar with them. We haven't seen it much in public safety, but I'm also in this tool that the Dakota County has chosen to use. I wouldn't be surprised if there are public safety entities that had to use the same tool, because again, you know, we have a lot of counties that have good coverage within their core cities that don't have to use the sheriff's department to cover them. But here again, they, you know, in this situation, the the county has to put resources in the southern part of the county. And so your questions are very good, but I think that we already have set precedents in the fire taxing districts as well as the ambulance taxing districts. And I guess we can even bring it to the hospital taxing districts. But, I mean, we have subordinate taxing districts around the state. So I think that it's already – the door has already been opened on those years ago.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
I actually used the examples of the fire departments. They're not a county. We're talking county, right? You're specifically counting one county for this exemption. And I don't see that using non-county functions is equivalent. I mean, if we set a precedent, it's about a function, a core function that the county is providing. And, you know, we have no answer to, yeah, we've got counties that are already doing this for that. If somebody's got the example of an actual core county function, that would be, address the question. But otherwise, my understanding is that we're setting a new precedent.
Representative Hewitt, I think I heard you say in your opening remarks that other counties in the state already have this ability. It's just in the metro area they do not. Did I hear you right when you said that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. They have the ability to do subordinate taxing districts. That's what these are called, and everywhere except the metro is allowed to do it, from what I understand. And also the only one in the metro that has reached outside of this is Anoka County. Like I said, I would not be surprised. I mean, it's a busy time in the legislature right now to get researchers to go into this. I found it was a little bit of a problem to find the answer that Representative Quam is going at. But I do respect his question, and we can definitely get back to him. But still, it doesn't change what this is about. This is very simple. This is townships, this is towns asking for more police protection, public safety, and they want it, local control. So this is where we have to do it at, and I think it's a good use. Normally I would probably be with Representative Quam on this, but I think that we need to move forward with this and give the county what they need in this case. Thank you.
Representative Quam, you want just a short response, or
Mr. Chair, I just every location this hits, I'll continue to ask for the documentation that we aren't setting a precedent. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Kosnick, you got your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got some comments I could. I'll reserve for privately with Representative Quam and myself. But I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank the Dakota County Sheriff, Leslie, and his deputies for the amount of work that they've been doing over a long period of time. And I will be supporting this to add more services to those areas of Dakota County. It does not affect my particular district, but I think there is precedent to do this. The taxpayers in those districts have options of asking for this or removing it by referendum. So there's precedent for it, as the author stated, and just keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Nash, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. If I understand it correctly, Representative Hewitt, this was at one time inclusive of the seven county metro area. I represent Carver County, so I talked to my sheriff. They may or may not be interested in utilizing this tool, but what was the rationale behind amending out the other counties and just making this about Dakota County, if you would?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, and I I believe, and if the commissioner can help me on this, I believe it was a compromise with the other counties that felt that they didn't want to do this. And so can I phone a friend here, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt. Yes, so in conversations with the other six counties that do not have this, they had said kind of this is something that they were not quite ready to do. This was something that Dakota County was ready now to do, and they were kind of, all eyes would be on Dakota if this was successful, particularly the suburban counties that also have the rural areas that are similar to this. So that was the rationale that as some objections were put in across the board, it was to just go in and try something as a Dakota County in this matter.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Nash.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be following the admission of my county apparently in that deliberation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, well, they're jumping around. Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt, why do you have 5% to create the district and 10% to dissolve it?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drozdowski, I am going to again turn this over to the county commissioner as they had a lot of influence over the reviser's edits in this bill. Can I have the commissioner answer this, please?
Commissioner Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answer I do not know. There was a number of revisions that might have been an oversight. On that part in there, looking at the bill here, I do see that, and I don't actually know the answer to that question, but I will certainly make sure that we get that found out and addressed, unless I get a text on something in the interim with questions to be able to answer that question for you. I do apologize, Representative Drozdowski, on that, but I don't know the answer.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Hewitt and Mr. Slavik, I would suggest you do the reciprocal of that and have 10% in order to create more government and then 5% to disband it. I think that might be a better representation of the needs of the taxpayers and protection of them. The way it's currently structured is inherently a government building approach. Another question, Mr. Chair, if I could, and Representative Hewitt, and I'm trying to fully understand the bill as I read it, but so if you're going to increase taxes on people in this special use district, do the taxes outside of the district decrease for people?
Representative Hewitt.
That answer did come up to us, and no, they will not decrease. As right now, this part of the county is taking, would we say, more than their fair share of what is laid out for the whole county. So this is staying ahead of the game, so they can also, they're going to still get their portion of the levied taxes across the county, but because they're requesting more public safety assets, they're going to be paying for them versus sending that up to Egan or Lakeville or wherever. So that's my understanding, is that the levy, the equalization throughout the county will stay, but these folks in this part of the county are requiring more public safety protection. And it's a good, Representative Drozdowski, it's a fairly decent, good deal, because they don't have to build a police station. They don't have to hire their own police officer, pay their own insurance, all those things that encompass the public safety. These towns would be, towns and townships would be devastated. So it's a pretty wraparound deal for them. Thank you for the question.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. I'll be voting no. This is a one-way check valve that says a government grows bigger with this bill. And that's what we're doing here, is giving county government the ability to grow bigger with part of its county taxpayers not being able to control that. So this member will be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. Regarding the last comment, to me, it's not logical. I just want to emphasize again, most of the communities in Dakota County have their police departments, and they're investing huge amounts of money in their police departments. All this does is give the communities in the southern portion of the state a way to have additional coverage, and it's a matter of equity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Skowski, your hand's still up. Did you have another question?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, as I've been listening to this conversation, it occurs to me that, you know, what the people who live in these townships are asking for is to be able to have a level of police patrol coverage that they would have if they were municipalities. If they were municipalities, then they would have police departments and would be able to tax their residents through the municipality to provide that level of patrol coverage. But they don't want to become cities. They're happy to stay townships. And this is just giving them a way to tax themselves to provide the level of patrol coverage that they would have if they were cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any further questions? If not, Representative Hewitt, I'll give you the chance to wrap up, and then we'll get to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. It's really robust. Real quick in summary, this is a vote on public safety and local control. Representative Drzalski, the reason the bill was written that way for the 10 and the 5 and 10% were it mirrors what Anoka County's doing. And the Anoka County, actually, theirs is much broader. They can use it for more than public safety. They use it for several other things. So shows how quick you can get research done. I'd like to thank you for your time. And Representative Quam, as this bill moves through, we can look at your questions. And Representative Drzalski, it's going to go to the floor, hopefully. And hopefully by the time it gets there, I've gotten you, because I know you're big on local control, and I definitely know you're big on public safety. So thank you, everybody.
With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 2894 be sent to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, can you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Chair Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drzalski.
No.
Drzalski votes nay. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborne.
Aye.
Cleborne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, aye.
Pulowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam votes nay. Representative Nash.
Nash votes no.
Nash votes nay. With that, Chair, with a vote of 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Members, the next bill we have on the agenda is House File 2454. Nate Nelson, Representative Nate Nelson, has the bill. And so I'll move that House File 2454 be referred to the General Register. Representative Nelson, please present your bill. Welcome to the committee.
All right, thank you, Chair Nelson. And I think we got a theme of a bunch of Nelsons happening right here. So I think it's the first time we've had it in committee meeting. So thank you for hearing this bill today.
You can't go anywhere in Minnesota without running into a Nelson.
Or a Johnson or an Anderson.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, well, thank you for hearing this bill today. And as HF 2454, it's a bill that would allow the Mora Public Utilities Commission to move to a five-person commission. Right now, they are a three-member board under as described under statute, and they would like to be able to go to a two additional members to be able to allow them to just a little bit more transparency, and it's minimal cost. They do the Public Utilities Commission has a budget about $8 million per year, and you know, and that's quite a lot for three members to decide. And and also when you look at you know, small towns and the open meeting laws, when you have a new member on the board and you end up meeting in the grocery store or something, you've got to be extremely careful what you say, otherwise you could be in violation of an open meeting law or something like that. So I do have a couple of testifiers here, Mayor Alan Scramstead, and then also the Greg Gardner that serves on the PUC. So I will have them. They are available to testify, and I would yield to them.
And I see on my screen we have two young gentlemen sitting there. And, I hope that's both Mr. Gardner and Mr. Scramstead. I have on my list, Greg Gardner from the Public Utilities Commission. Do you want to raise your hand? And you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Gardner, and I do serve as chairman of the Public Utilities Commission here in Mora. I represent a three-person commission that oversees all aspects of our electrical, water, sanitary, sewage, utilities within the city of Mora. As Representative Nelson said, this board manages a fiscal budget of approximately $8 million a year and oversees reserves of almost $23 million. We do this by providing up-to-date and cost-effective utilities for our residents. We make investments to secure proper utility upgrades and to counter any catastrophic issues that might arise in the future. We provide programs and incentives for our customers. We encourage conservation through best practices and rebates. We employ the staff for very different but necessary utilities across the board. We oversee monthly collections and resolutions to provide utility services. My reasons for support for House File 2454 are a number of things here. A three-person commission has inherent difficulties. Our changing demographics for commission members, we have younger members now that have conflicting priorities due to family, business, illness, or other personal business. Absence of even one member puts more pressure on the other two. Absence of two members and there is no quorum, decisions need to be put off at the expense of staff and customers. A five-member board would help to reduce these issues. Finally, precedent has been set by the legislature with regards to the cities of North Branch, Melrose, and Elk River to establish a five-member board. I've been involved with the city of Mora for approximately 30 years. I've served as mayor, councilperson, planning commission member, economic development authority president, many other city boards and commissions. In each case, all of these city groups are represented by a five-member board. It's hard to understand why the Mora Public Utility Commission, which is the largest monetary entity in the city of Mora, is limited to just three members. I ask for your support for House File 2454. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Alan Scramstead, the mayor, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Alan Scramstead. I am the mayor of Mora, and I'm on my fourth year as mayor. And welcome to the city. We just got done with this past weekend of celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Mora Los Alopit. I'm in here to ask for support on House File 2454. It is, as Commissioner Gardner said, that it is difficult for a three-person board to be in charge of such a large fiscal unit in the city. They do well, but if one member gets sick for any length of time, all the pressure falls on two. If two of them happen to be called out of town, they can't hold a meeting. And the council then has no reliable input for the next council meeting for the utilities issues. So we are asking for your support for this file to go on, and thank you for allowing us the time to testify.
Thank you, Mayor Scramstead. Members, questions from the members? Questions from the members? If not, wait a couple seconds here. If not, Representative Nelson, you can wrap up the bill, and then we'll get to a vote.
All right, thank you. And if there are any questions, we'd be happy to have them. But otherwise, I would appreciate your support. And I don't know if it was mentioned, but the council members, their compensation is about $2,000 a year. So this is not a big ask. It's going to cost the city about $4,000. The residents. And I see that as a really small ask when they're overseeing an $8 million budget. And so if you would, I would appreciate your support today. Thank you.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2454 be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, if you want to take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye. Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam votes aye. Chair Nelson, with a vote of 13 ayes, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. And members, we have it's the last of the bills we have on for this morning's meeting. We shortly will be recessing. When we come back this evening, we've got two more bills that we need to get taken up. We'll use the same Zoom link to get back on the committee tonight. And with that, members, unless there's questions, we're in recess till 6 o'clock this evening. Thank you, members. Good evening, everybody. We reconvene this meeting, call it to order for the House State Government Finance and Elections Committee. We have two bills to finish up here tonight. And the first one is House File 3190. And I'll move the bill to have it before us, but the intention here is to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Welcome to committee, Representative Long, if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two amendments. Would you like me to move those now?
Yes. Why don't we do the amendments first to get them in the order you want? And which amendment do you want to do first?
Why don't we do the A5 first, Mr. Chair?
Okay, the A5 amendments. I'll move the A5 amendment. You want to explain what this amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This just gets the bill in the shape I want. It makes some technical corrections and then clarifies when disclosure is required for online ads.
Okay, members, any questions of the amendment? If not, everybody unmute and we'll vote. All in favor of the A5 amendment to put the bill in the way the Representative Long wants it. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Then what's the next amendment you'd like to do, sir?
The A6, please, Mr. Chair.
The A6 amendment. Pull it up here so I can see what it is. 4, A5, Well, I'll move the A6 amendment. Do you want to explain what the A6 amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Between our last committee meeting and this one, we got our fiscal note back, and the campaign finance board has said that they would have $5,000 of cost that they cannot absorb. So this would appropriate those $5,000.
Okay. Any discussion on this amendment, the A6 amendment? If not, again, unmute. All in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. And then I see an A3 and an A4, Representative Long. Are either one of those yours?
Mr. Chair, those are the amendments I have offered for tonight. I think the A3 might have been mine previously, but it was updated by the A5.
Okay, that's good to know.
And Mr. Chair, I have the A4.
Representative Nash, do you want to offer the A4 amendment?
Yes, sir. I would move the A4 and would request a roll call on this.
A4 has been moved and a roll call has been requested. You want to explain what this does, Representative Long, or excuse me, Representative Nash?
Well, Representative Long could do that, but I think you should do it.
Yeah.
I think I will. So the A4 would really address the issue that we saw at the last caucus in certain cities in our state where folks who were not eligible voters were welcomed warmly into the caucus system. And I think that all of us agree that we want those who are eligible voters who should be voting, we want to encourage that and make it as easy as possible. But for those that choose to circumvent that process and potentially begin involving people in the electoral process who honestly aren't able to vote in our state, I think there should be some ramifications. So what this would do would be to remove that major political party status of that offending party by doing this. And honestly, members, this is, we say, and we said the other day, I believe, and I forget which election bill it was, but that we want to encourage all eligible legal voters to do so. Well, that didn't happen. So I think that there should be some ramifications for that. I would hope that you would support this. I think that it is a very honest attempt to say that while we certainly want to listen to voices, casting a vote in the ballot box belongs only to those people who are legal eligible voters. So once again, Mr. Chair, thank you for the roll call, and I would ask for your support on the A4.
And open up for questions here. I'm going to start out with one question I have reading the amendment. On line 1.12 of your amendment, it talks about or individuals convicted of a felony. And it's my understanding that there's a lot of people who are convicted of a felony, and when they get off paper, they can finish their terms of their imprisonment and their probation, and they get off paper. In Minnesota, those people regain their right to vote. But the way this is written, if you got convicted of a felony, whenever, and now you've completed your sentence and you're completely done with that, they still would not be able to participate in the caucus. Is that your intent?
And Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I believe you said line 1.2. Did you mean 1.12?
I thought I said 1.12.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for that question. And I would be happy to engross that as a friendly amendment that you're offering in support of this amendment to make it so that those who are off paper certainly can vote. But if you would like to offer that as a friendly amendment in support of this, I'm sure Mr. Gehring would be able to incorporate that.
At this time, I'm not. I just wanted the question, make sure we had it there. Any other questions of the Nash's amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Long, what is your pleasure, or what do you feel about this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What is your pleasure? I guess I ask that always of the authors of the bill. What's the amendment?
Well, I would be pleased if members voted against the amendment. I certainly understand the political point Representative Nash is trying to make, but it really doesn't have anything to do with disclosure or the underlying bill at all. And so if there was a germaneness role in committee, then this would fail it. But I think members should oppose it so that we can keep the bill focused on disclosure. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. Any other comments on the amendment? If not, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious what the author thinks about the Democratic Party's intentional violation of the law as referenced in the amendment.
Representative Nash.
Representative Drazkowski, was that to the author of the amendment or the
author? The author of the bill, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, the author of the bill. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's really not the subject of tonight's hearing. And so I'd be happy to discuss it with you offline, Representative Drazkowski, but I don't think that's pertinent to today's bill hearing.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess if I was a Democrat and realized that they had just intentionally violated the law for caucuses, I wouldn't have an answer either. But thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Any other questions? If not, Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
No.
Nelson votes nay. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, no.
Carlson votes nay. Representative Nash.
Nash votes yes.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner. Representative Drazkowski.
Yes.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes no.
Elkins votes nay. Representative Greenman.
No.
Greenman votes nay. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, no.
Cleavorn votes nay. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, nay.
Pawlowski votes nay. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Representative Bonner. Representative Mason. Chair Nelson, with a vote of 5 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does not prevail.
The motion does not prevail. There are no more amendments. We'll go to the testifiers. On my testifiers list, I have first one is Aaron McKean. Mr. McKean, if you want to state your name for the record and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aaron McKean, and I'm legal counsel with the Campaign Legal Center. And we're in support of House File 3190 because it would update Minnesota's campaign finance laws to ensure that Minnesota voters have the information, have more information about who is trying to influence their vote. We've provided written testimony in support of this bill, but I just want to provide a few key highlights about why this bill is so important. And just to begin with, House File 3190 is responding to the vast increase in independent spending that we've seen in our elections over the last 10 years. And what we know about that spending is it's often secret spending or anonymous spending. And it's often wealthy special interests who are spending money in our elections in a way that evades transparency and leaves voters in the dark about who's trying to influence their vote. Now, House File 3190 includes reforms that are built on provisions in other states that have successfully updated their disclosure laws to ensure that, that voters have this information. And in addition to building on those successes in other states, these reforms are also supported by almost 50 years of Supreme Court precedent upholding the constitutionality of transparency in election-related spending. Beginning almost 50 years ago with Buckley versus Valeo, the Supreme Court has recognized that transparency supports three important interests in our democracy. It ensures that voters have information about who is spending to influence their vote so they can make decisions in the political marketplace. And then it also deters corruption and deters the appearance of corruption. And then finally, disclosure also helps enforce other campaign finance laws like contribution limits. We support House File 3190 because it provides this important information for voters in Minnesota. and we encourage the committee to support this bill as well. I'm happy to answer any questions. Appreciate your time this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKean. We'll do questions after we get the other, I guess there's only one more testifier. Ms. Arlene Dadu, please identify yourself for the tape, and I'm sorry if I butchered your last name, but begin with your testimony.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Arlene Dadu, and I live in St. Paul. I grew up in Chicago as a daughter of Filipino immigrants who came to the United States after World War II. My parents' version of success in America meant going to college and getting a good job, getting married, and settling down, fulfilling the ideals of the American dream. I spent most of my career working in communications at a number of major corporations in Chicago and Minnesota. I put my heart and soul into defending them through media and public relations. But it was in 2003 that I was first exposed to community organizing and public advocacy here in Minnesota, and it opened my eyes to the truth I had been missing. Corporations only look out for themselves. We were told time and time again that their most important resources were us, their employees. They told us we're a team and we're in this together, when in reality, we were the first to get cheated when anything went south. They prioritized their shareholders, which are often the executives and CEOs of the companies themselves, and only look out for their own investments. It's been made very clear to me, corporate interests are very different from the community's interests. Yet corporations and other special interests have massive influence on who runs for office and what issues they decide to talk about. I often felt pressure to give to our company's corporate PAC, unsure whether or not my reputation or job security would be on the line if I didn't follow the standard. Oftentimes, I wasn't told where my money would go or what it would end up influencing. It is absolutely essential that we change our current system to limit the influence of these corporate actors. In the recent, the last presidential election, we saw an influx of grassroots donors who felt empowered to elect leaders who represented them and their communities. But corporations funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars through many different and often dark channels. In order to create a system that works for all of us, we need to expand access to voting and make it possible for people's votes to count through both their vote and financial means. But right now, we are currently at a disadvantage against corporations. We have to close the loopholes in our campaign finance system and restore power to Minnesotans. I think House File 3190 is a necessary step in the right direction to do just that, and I encourage the committee to support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Dadu. Representative Long, I forgot to allow you to explain your bill, and I'm sorry about that. It's been a long day here, so Representative Long, would you explain the bill, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I think the testifiers did a good job laying out the basic principle behind this bill, but it stands for the really, I think, core concept that when voters are doing their civic duty and deciding how to cast their ballot, they should have information about who is trying to influence that decision. And so this bill would really simply just require the disclosure of the top three largest donors to independent expenditures on ads. Doesn't stop any speech, does not even curtail any speech. All it does is help voters make better informed choices. I did a little bit of research for this committee meeting tonight about the real names of some independent expenditure committees in Minnesota, which include names like Advance Minnesota, Minnesotans for Bold Reform, Minnesota's Future, Minnesota for All, and We Are Minnesota. Our current law requires that these committee names be disclosed, as well as that the expenditure was not coordinated with a candidate. But these names, as you can tell, are designed to be generic and give voters basically no information about the content or who is behind it. If the ad you see is from Minnesotans for Sunshine and Puppies, but it's backed by somebody with a clear political point of view, you would want to know that. Could there be an appearance of corruption? Could there be a financial interest involved? Voters want to know. In fact, 83% of voters across party lines support public disclosure of contributions to groups involved in elections. All donor information over $200 already has to be disclosed in reports to the Campaign Finance Board, but there's often a delay between the report and when voters need the information to make a voting decision. Sometimes that is manipulated intentionally by folks who want to hide their identities from the public. And also, most voters won't have the time to dig through campaign finance reports. I included a graphic in the materials that shows the increase of independent expenditures over time. In 2018, independent expenditures outspent candidates by about $5 million in Minnesota. And in our last election in 2020, they outspent candidates by $15 million. So we're seeing more and more campaign spending run through independent channels, which makes the importance of transparency only grow. And as was mentioned, there are six states now that have similar requirements to this bill, including Maine, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Hawaii, Washington, and our neighbors in South Dakota. So I'd urge that we not let South Dakota outgood govern us. And I thank you for the time, Mr. Chair, and urge members' support.
Questions, members of the bill? Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. I do have some questions about the bill. It took me some time to go through the amendment while everybody was talking. I apologize, so hopefully I didn't miss anything, but I think that I got everything in order. So I know you deleted lines 19 and 20 on page one, but I think that's the same thing as essentially covered in lines 15 through 18. So my question is, first of all, who makes the determination on reasonable interpretation?
Representative Long.
The Campaign Finance Board.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. Okay, we have heard from them in the past that there is significant hours involved in that, so I'm a little surprised that the appropriation is just $5,000 for them. I would love to see an actual fiscal note so that we have that breakdown. That's typically how we do things. In fact, has a fiscal note been requested?
Representative Long, I believe so.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, it's been requested and completed. I think it's in the packets, and was only a $5,000 cost, which is the A6 amendment that we added.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm looking at this, there are no exceptions. There is no, there are no clear guidelines on what this means. So I'm wondering, if for example, a city put out a newsletter thanking a legislator for doing something, could that be interpreted as an appeal advocating the election or defeat?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's not a lot of details in that hypothetical, but I don't think so, based on what you just shared. We're talking about advocating the election or defeat, and the language says that it has to be clear that there's no reasonable interpretation other than that's what it was intending to do. I think in the hypothetical you gave, there's a reasonable interpretation that they might just be thanking them for work they've done.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. I think this is where we run into the problem, right? There's no definition. So one person's definition of reasonably, no reasonable interpretation is going to be different from another's. This is the problem with using subjective language when we are writing laws. I would ask another question. So for example, in my first election, I had a constituent actually who tried several times submitting a letter to the editor to support my candidacy, and they wouldn't print it. And so finally, he took out his own ad in the newspaper. Would he fall under this?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't, if it was an ad that he was paying for and he was advocating for the election or defeat of a candidate, then potentially I'm not sure if Mr. McKean's aware of a circumstance like that that's come up in other states.
Representative New Brindley.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Brindley, if Mr. Sigurdsson has his hand up, maybe he can give an answer to the question. Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. There are multiple factors that come into play here. In addition to the language of the communication as referenced by Representative New Brindley, there would also be the question about whether or not it would cost was over $1,500. That's the threshold in Minnesota. If the advertisement didn't cost over $1,500, it could be expressly advocating it could be using the standard here you see here, a functional equivalent. It wouldn't matter if it doesn't go over that threshold.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. That is helpful. What about, typically when we've heard similar bills in the past, there have been exceptions for certain groups. So for example, an endorsement from an editorial board, would that fall under this? Because arguably the value would be more than $1,500 to have an endorsement from an editorial board of a major newspaper.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chair Nelson, Representative New Brindley, there is already a specific set of references in Chapter 10A that exclude endorsements from the definition of independent expenditures, so they would not.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what about a voter guide?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Sigurdsson.
I'm sorry. Representative Chair, Representative New Brindley. Voter guide, it would then come into the question of, the reasonable interpretation. Generally, I think the answer would be yes. I mean, because it is, after all, a voter guide. So it would be a reasonable interpretation to assume that the point that's being put out for is to, in fact, influence the nomination or election of a candidate. I think in most cases, you have seen courts support the idea that a voter guide, regardless of whether or not they use words of express advocacy, has no other reasonable purpose other than to try to influence elections.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. That is helpful also. Clearly, we have a problem here again with subjective language. Some of these items, yes, some of these items, no, but they would all be a question mark. And therefore, they are up to someone's subjective interpretation, which is problematic. My next question is, you talk about the top three contributors that they are directly required to be in the disclosure. And so Representative Long, I'm wondering, we currently don't have to disclose any donor who donates less than $200. But there is no exception in your language for that. So if someone donates less than $200 under your bill, will they still have to be disclosed?
Representative Long.
Thank you for the question. So let me first respond to your prior point. The purpose of the language that is not just limiting express advocacy to phrases of express advocacy, the so-called magic words test, is that that's really easy to get around. And it is very simple for an independent expenditure to not use vote for, vote against in an ad and to get around that express advocacy definition. So that's why we need to have the additional definition here that shows that there's no reasonable interpretation other than express advocacy. To your question on the amount, there's not a threshold right now in the bill. I'd certainly be open to a discussion if you have one in mind, but it feels like a top three political donor category is one where you're not likely to catch very many folks in the $50 to $100 range who are contributing. I don't know very many independent expenditures that you can run that cheaply, but if that was a major concern and would earn your support, Representative New Brindley, I'd be happy to talk about making changes in that regard.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly understand the intention of the bill. The problem is not with the intention. The problem is with the actual language. So what we're saying is that we no longer have privacy for donors who give under $200 if they happen to be the largest donors for these pieces of literature, whatever those may be. The other question is on lines 2.17 to 2.19, you say that those donors, it's whatever donors gave the most amount of money during the 12-month period preceding the expenditure. So that's not currently how we track campaign finance. We are typically, well, as legislators, I mean, those are typically done annually. And then, of course, during election cycles, they are a really random reporting cycle. So this does not match any current reporting cycle. So are all of the organizations involved going to now have to track their donations on a different cycle? Are you going to adjust the campaign finance reporting so that these things can match up? Or are you just going to have completely different randomized reporting that everyone is now going to have to track?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. No, this would not change any reporting to the CFB. The goal is to try to prevent there being manipulation of when people are giving to try to avoid public disclosure. And so if you have a 12-month period based on the date of the ad, that's a very fair way, I think, to avoid entities trying to get around disclosure requirements. And I would think most entities are tracking the date that they're getting donations anyway, so it should not be that hard for them to track who their top three donors were.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, once again, a goal is not the same thing as the actual language. So what we are saying is we are going to force every organization to now track their contributions differently than how they are currently tracking them, which is likely going to create a great deal of confusion among those different organizations. My last question is on page three in subdivision three, you are turning over rulemaking on disclosure for electronic communications to the Campaign Finance Board. Currently, we as a legislature have always taken that responsibility, and we have determined disclosures. Why are you choosing to abdicate our legislative authority on this and hand that over to the board instead?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. This area of digital communications is rapidly evolving, and there are new types of ads, new forms of ads, and so it's one where having the nimbleness that the Campaign Finance Board does to address it is, I think, the right approach, and we've set out a fair standard, which is that if it's not able to be read in a clear way on the communication, then they need to come up with another form for having the disclosure. And that seems like a fair standard for the legislature to set out.
I see the finger coming up, but I thought you said that was the last question. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. As it turns out, we meet as a legislature every year, and certainly we are capable of doing these things. I would just say, I mean, the bill overall is problematic. Lots of goals, lots of intentions, and lots of subjectivity. It's hugely problematic. And frankly, with this last subdivision, that's a real problem. I mean, just because most Democrats struggle with solving really easy common sense problems like UI, it doesn't mean we should abdicate our responsibility as a legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative New Brindley. But let me just say that we, in a lot of cases, we have parts of parts of our government that make rules, and there's rule making all going on all the time. And this is nothing new. We're not able to get into the minutia all the time. But thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Druskowski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do subscribe just generally to Representative New Brindley's talking about it. However, this is a pretty small bill in that regard. I have a question for Mr. Sigurdsson, and it's just a general question. Mr. Sigurdsson expressly advocating, other than for kind of this area of statute and independent expenditures, what areas does this definition impinge upon?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, there would be no other areas in Chapter 10. Chapter 10A, the definition of express advocacy is only used in reference to what is an independent expenditure. The definition of what's a campaign expenditure uses a different definition and doesn't rely on expressly advocating. So it's only in how you look at the question of independent expenditures that would be affected by this legislation.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Really, that's really my only question. Representative Long, thank you for your work on this bill. I do think we need to bring more transparency like this. Representative Long, just quickly, another question just popped into my head. We heard from one testifier who didn't like corporations, contributing. Many of us think unions provide the same problem on the other side. Is there anything in the design of this bill that suggests that it's targeted at one side of the aisle more than the other?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Drazkowski. No, there is not. This is all donors of all types, and it's really meant to be equal opportunity transparency so that voters have information that can help them make good decisions about how to evaluate independent expenditures when they're pulling that lever of the ballot box.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. It may be that we need to provide real good scrutiny to this language because it's really important and kind of the what ifs and what could happen. I think everybody's kind of tepid about that, but I'm going to support the bill going out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski and members. As I said, this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in a further bill. Representative, any further questions before I hand it over to Representative Long to wrap up? And I'll wait just one more second here. And Representative Long, you want to wrap up your bill and
thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would. I'll just, I think Representative Drazkowski made the point well that this is not designed to be a partisan bill. This is, in fact, as I mentioned, disclosure is 87% public support and very bipartisan. I think Mr. McKean pointed out that even the conservative Supreme Court in an 8-1 decision noted that disclosure is a good thing and constitutional. And in fact can help voters make better informed decisions. So I would urge members' support when we bring this bill back.
Thank you, Representative Long. And with that, thank you for your time this evening. The last bill we have on the agenda is House File 2857, Representative Nash. And again, I'll move the bill to put it before us, but we're gonna be laying this one over also for possible inclusion. So Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was of the assumption and agreement with, I think, your CA that this was being moved to the general register.
For right now, that's we're going to lay it over for right now and possibly bundle it with a bunch of other election bills and have one bill coming out of here. Because there may be, I don't think those might have costs, but we just want to make sure that until we get our targets, we don't have a cost that was going to come back and bite us.
Well, that's certainly very different than I had been told by your folks. This is the first I've heard that it's going to be laid over. So that's a bit of a surprise, Mr. Chair, but I would bring this before the committee. The 2857 bill is pretty straightforward. It says that if an organization that could be on either side of the aisle is going to send out a ballot, an absentee ballot request form, then on the outside of the ballot or outside of the envelope, it has to say, this is not an actual ballot. Now, many of you probably went through the same thing that I did, hearing from countless constituents who said, I think I've been sent a real ballot, a live ballot. And that causes a lot of confusion for people. And I think that this is a great solution for it. The language here is not onerous. The cost to the organization to print something on the outside of an envelope is absolutely no more than they're currently paying. And I really can't imagine what the fiscal note for this would be, Mr. Chair. So I'm confused by that once again, that a bill that you're the co-author on that we're holding in committee to include in an omnibus bill. Still confused about that. Perhaps we could talk about getting this out of committee. I still am confused as to how we got there, but the gist of the bill is we should be about the business of removing confusion for people. Much like I'm confused with why you're holding this in committee, the people in our districts are confused as to why they get 8, 10, 12 absentee ballot request forms. They can still do that under this bill, but on the outside of each of those outer envelopes, it would say this is not an actual ballot. And that's the bill.
Questions for the bill? I see we have one person signed up to testify. Ms. Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office. Ms. Freeman, are you here to have, do you have testimony or are you just here to answer questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just here to answer questions.
Thank you for that. Members' questions.
And Mr. Chair, I believe if I could address your concern over a fiscal note, I believe that that was requested and it came back. There wasn't, I'm not sure that we had it back, but I don't believe there was one. So perhaps you would be able to guarantee me that if this does not have a fiscal note, that we will send it to the floor by itself where it belongs.
We can see what happens in the future. I see two hands up. Representative Greenman, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ash, and I appreciate that we got a chance to talk about this, I think, a week or two ago. I just had a few clarification questions. When I was reading the language and just in terms of confusion, in subdivision 1-2, I think line 1.13, the language says the application or ballot has not been included at the request of the government official. And I was wondering, so nobody should be sending a ballot except for the government. And so that was just confusing to me.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. The goal of this piece of language that we worked on with the revisor was to make it so that people didn't think that the application form was coming directly from the government as a ballot. So trying once again to remove any confusion, because obviously when you do sign up for an actual ballot, the delivery of it does come from the government, but this is trying to say that the application, as it says in line 1.13, the application it has not been sent out at the request of the government official.
It does say application or ballot, but yeah, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so that I'm clear, does that mean that or ballot is not meant to be there? Or I hear what you're saying in terms of the intention. When I read, if I read it, opened up a piece of mail and said the application or ballot has not been included at the request of the government official, I might think that there's a ballot that's not coming from the government.
Yeah, and if I could, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Gehring is on the line with us, and he and I worked together to draft this. If he could maybe help with a phone a friend for the drafter of this bill.
And I see he turned his camera on, so usually that means he wants to say something. Mr. Gehring, you want to introduce yourself? And
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. So just to clarify the structure of this language, it does include mailings that include applications for absentee ballots as well as sample ballots. So that reference you're seeing in clause 2 to ballots is a reference to a mailing that would have a sample ballot included. And the idea would be that the language would require the sender of that sample ballot to make clear that it's not a government official sending either the application or the sample ballot.
Representative Greenman, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that feels vernacularly confusing because my experience is sample ballots may be a lit piece with a bunch of people's names on it. It may be a number of things. So I just would say, I think on this piece, I think that that feels confusing. And I know that part of the goal of this is to eliminate voter confusion. So I would just, that language is confusing to me. So I'm not sure if there's an opportunity to work on that. I do have another question for about subdivision 2. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because the subdivision 2 seems that is different than the notice requirement on the envelope. That is a prohibition that absentee ballot applications that would be probably inside the envelope can't be pre-printed. And I am wondering how a county would know, like if they get an absentee ballot application back, and there is sometimes people type it, sometimes people electronically fill it out and send it out. But if they got it, a pre-printed absentee ballot, and they sent it back, how would a county or administrator know that it was sent to them in error or wrongly?
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, you bring up a fair point. The goal of this was to, I'll use the terms that a constituent used, it freaked them out when a ballot request form came completely filled out. And I believe they said that there was a little sticky arrow note that says, just sign here, and that everything else was taken care of. And, you know, once again, we're trying to make it so that people recognize that they have the opportunity to submit for an absentee ballot, and that they can do so no fault in our state now, but that we're trying to make it a little less creepy, and so that they don't feel like they're being pushed or bolstered into something. So that was the gist of this. And to your previous comment, apparently, since the chair doesn't want to move this on, as we had agreed, we have apparently opportunity to work on this, which is both disappointing and, I guess, for you, encouraging. But once again, I think that this is a very straightforward approach to remove confusion for voters, because I would bet all the money in my pocket against all the money in your pocket, if we were a betting state and Representative Garofalo got what he wanted, that you had a lot of calls from people who were absolutely confused beyond words. And this is meant to create a lot of clarity for them. So just trying to get people who are going to be sending these out to be a little less, to create less confusion for the people who are going to be receiving them.
I got a question for Ms. Freeman. Ms. Freeman, on the Secretary of State's website, can I go on and fill out a PDF form that would then print off on my computer that I can then mail in to do for a or absentee ballot? And I guess to what the question that Representative Freeman had, how would anyone know whether that was printed off from the Secretary of State site, me filling in the PDF form, or me getting that in the mail and signing it and sending it off? How would they be able to determine which is which? Ms. Freeman.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The form is available, the PDF, that is the form that many entities use if they mail it out. There's in state law, there's just required that certain information is on an application, so it's not required that the form on our website be used, but it is available for people to, you know, print out and fill out either by hand or type and fill out. Any of those methods are acceptable. If the application, you know, looks like the standard form, I am not sure what mechanism there'd be available for a county official or a election administrator to determine where the form came from. Other than, you know, there's a matching process and verification that ID numbers match and date of birth match and that the voter is registered and all of those processes, of course. But I think that was one of the concerns. That was a question that we had around that prohibition, is just what would the responsibility be for the county administrators then?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure we've all seen many of these applications that get mailed to folks. It isn't only just the application PDF that has been downloaded from the Secretary of State webpage. And I appreciate the representative from the Secretary's office just nodding in agreement with that. It is oftentimes filled out, and then other messages from the particular entity that's trying to get you to fill it out is wrapped in around it. So we are trying to say to those people, you can't pre-fill this out. That is the intent of the bill.
Representative Greenman, you have another question?
Yeah, I appreciate the, I think am committed to, and we have talked about the issue that happened in the 2020 race of just people getting a lot of different kinds of mailings. And I think there's a few different things that are part of the solution. One of them is permanent absentee folks who sign up for a permanent absentee ballot and think they're going to get it and then get another application. I know that that's not what this is dealing with, but I think that's a part of the solution. But to this, and I think sort of back to subdivision two, do you have a sense, so if let's say an independent expenditure sends it out and it's pre-filled, somebody sends it back, is there any consequences to that voter if that happens, if this law passes?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the consequence to the voter, I don't believe there would be, but to the organization that has, if this were to pass, after the chair obviously lets it out of committee, the consequence would be on those who are sending it out, not the voter themselves, to answer your question.
I got two other people with their hands up. I'm going to go to the other questions. Representative Carlson, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are a little more, I guess, elementary. I'm familiar with the documents which we are talking about, and I just wish we had a visual or an example of, how this could be displayed. I'm always concerned that, I love the intent of what this bill is trying to achieve, that there's a clear understanding, at least amongst us decision makers, in terms of how that would play out in real life. So I guess my question is Representative Nash, for example, where it says markings to clearly distinguish it from official election mail sent by a unit of government. I wish we had an example that you could do a screen share or some way, to the best of your ability to describe in words the intent of that. Because I think what I might be envisioning might be different than what others are thinking. Do you have some thoughts on that or some way that can be more clearly articulated?
Representative Nash, and I've got a few of those in the mail myself the last election cycle. I didn't save any of them, but yeah, Representative Nash.
Yeah, well, thank you for the support there, Mr. Chair. The goal, again, is to get rid of the confusion and to make it so that someone who goes to the mailbox and takes out one of the, I would say, intentionally, not misleading, but intentionally motivating actions of this looks like an official ballot. We want to prevent that. So I'm not sure that there's any other deep in the weeds or nefarious intent there, Representative Carlson. It is to create a greater sense of clarity. And no. I would be amazed if you didn't see these during the last election, because I know that everybody that I talked to was blown away at the number of pieces of mail that went into their district from organizations on both sides of the aisle trying to get someone to fill out an absentee ballot request form and saying, well, the Sierra Fund got me to fill out my absentee ballot, or the NRA got me to set it out. We're trying to avoid confusion by simply saying, mark the exterior of the envelope that this is not from a unit of government. This is from pick your favorite organization here, and that this is not an actual ballot. It's that simple. So again, I appreciate the chair being my co-author, and I appreciate the support and sentiment apparently of everybody in the committee, even though we're not apparently moving this out. The goal is not to subvert anything that you may think. It's very simple. Create clarity. That's the goal.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, well, thank you, Representative Ashton. To quote Representative New Brindley, with bills, with good goals and intentions, we need to focus on the language that's before us. And that's really all I'm getting at. I'm quite aware of the problem to which we are trying to solve. And I do hope that you do see that the conversation we're having now is an attempt to get this right, so that we don't do the opposite of what we're intending to do, which would be to create more confusion. So please take this as constructive criticism. And again, I think with with the conversation we're having here today, we can work towards a solution that could truly benefit all Minnesotans.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, a good place to do the amending of things would be on the floor of the House. I'd be happy to bring an amendment to the floor if it were to be released from committee, and we could actually work on those things. But the problem is it sounds like it's going to be held for a mini elections omnibus bill to make things that we don't want to vote for look all the more appealing and create in and of itself through that action greater confusion around this issue. So thank you.
And Representative Nash, I wouldn't do it on a controversial election bill, but with this, it would be on a technical bill from the Secretary of State's office, a truly just technical bill.
Okay.
Or by itself. I'm not trying to kill it by making you forcing you to vote for something that you're not. Like I said, I understand there's going to be a technical bill coming forward, and it may even be part of what the Secretary of State brings forward. So, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, I'm actually in agreement with you for the need of clarification of what is an official application and what is an official ballot. You'll get no pushback from me on that. And I also will say to you, I think I got 60 at our house between the family members. It's a whole nother story, but I have a few concerns that I would like just to kind of for us to think about if we have time to work on this. There are a few spaces where I think pre-filling of these forms by groups could be quite helpful, and I want you to think about this. So I do a great deal of work legislatively with a group of individuals who are quadriplegic, so they can't fill out their own forms easily and efficiently. So there may be an organization that would facilitate that, and I would not want them to be penalized for helping them with that process. So that's one piece. And I realize it's a small exception in the big picture that you're talking about, but I want to make sure that we leave space. So think about potentially a church or a civic organization that helps serve new Americans, right? And they're excited, this is their first time to vote. Pre-populating these forms to them might make it easier for them to facilitate getting a ballot, right? So there are places where I can see that we might want to allow people who are not necessarily the Secretary of State, but facilitating individuals who may have difficulty doing it themselves. So I want you to think about that. I hope the nod is a positive thing, that maybe we could work on that language together. And then what do we do, because we've all seen these too, where you get an envelope that's got a huge red sticker on it that says official U.S. mail. Well, it's not really a falsehood. It's official United States postage, right? It's got a stamp on it. It's a real letter. But at the same time, it undermines exactly what you're trying to get at here. So it's something that we need to think about, right? What could be put on there? So maybe instead of trying to limit all of the, you like to use the phrase whack-a-moles, right? Instead of trying to limit all the whack-a-moles, maybe we could craft together a bill that would be permissive to say, this is what the language must be when it comes from the Secretary of State's office, so that people know that when they get it with that language, and when they call us, we can say, does it have this exact wording on it? And if their answer is no, because I, like you, had more of those calls than I wanted while I was trying to door knock, right? So there are pieces that we should maybe think about what permissive language of the Secretary of State or the county elections folks could they use so that we could quickly say to people, it has to have this seal, it needs to look like this, and it's official. So just a food for thought for us to work together.
I didn't hear a question there, and I see Representative Kosnick has his hand up. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the previous comments from the representative from Plymouth, maybe that some clarity would be appropriate. I hope you don't mean to imply that new Americans are not capable or smart enough to complete an application ballot, because your comments sort of indicate that. I think that's unfortunate.
There could be nothing further from
Representative Claiborne.
Representative Koznick, thank you for not addressing me by my name, but I will still address the disparaging remarks. I have twice lived outside of the United States, and people have very different types of script that they use. And it is not always easy for the people in the United States who are accustomed to looking at one type of writing to be able to decipher all of the types of writing that go on around the world. We have a rich diversity of script that people use, and that is all I meant by that comment. And so it is sometimes much easier to help people facilitate. And you can be a wonderful, wonderful American citizen and not speak English. So to having worked with official documents in other languages, I understand that it is very difficult sometimes. And so from my own experience of being fluent verbally, but not in a written capability in another language, I think sometimes offering assistance is very, very helpful. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you. I don't want to belabor the point, but I appreciate the author and the co-authors intent in that we don't want to be manipulating people's abilities to fill out application ballots and further manipulating their voting patterns. So thank you for bringing the bill forward.
And with that, I see no other hands up. Representative Nash, you want to do a wrap up and wrap up the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to all those who said that they support it. And I'm happy to work on language that may make you happier in your support. But once again, I hope this doesn't get held hostage in committee. I think that this is a valuable bill that, particularly in an election year, as we begin to have people who will be planning their efforts to send out these absentee ballot request forms, that it is something that we should actually get done quickly. And the sooner the better. So I would say, let's send it to the floor. We can work on amendments. I would make that last appeal to the chair. I understand that there may be a technical bill, but I think that if we can get this out to the people who will be sending these things out as they are planning what those will look like, the better we're going to wind up being. So once again, thank you to the chair for his co-authorship of this bill. And thank you for those that are in support of it. Again, I think the goal of this is to make it so that we do not bombard people with things that are confusing them, particularly around our elections. That is absolutely the goal of this, is to create clarity. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash and members. And before we adjourn, I was just going to say that our next meeting is Thursday, the 17th. We have some bills that are listed. There's a couple that have been pulled out because we haven't gotten them back yet, or we've been told that we won't get them back yet. But just pay attention. And like I said, we'll be meeting Thursday morning at our normal time. And with that, members, have a good night. We are adjourned.